afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. Today is the 4th of May, 2005, Wednesday, and you're listening to the Hour of the Time on WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 MHz and 9.330 MHz, out of Monticello, Maine. Now, if you'd like to write the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. If you'd like to visit our website, it's a wonderful website full of research materials, news updates, and it's been newly remodeled as of late. It is hourofthetime.com. Again, that's hourofthetime.com. Now, if you'd like to either contact myself or Rob Houghton, co-host and webmaster, the info is right there on the website. Just go to contact, and there's the phone numbers for Canada and the U.S., addresses, emails, everything's all listed there. Our studio line here, where you can leave a message if we don't answer, for questions, comments, and also for when we do call-in shows, it's the same number. It's 928-333-2942. That's 928-333-2942. Now, some quick announcements before we get on to today's special show. Our annual sale ran through the month of April is now over. That was 20% off all audios and individual videos. That is now over. The 12 set of DVDs, that price is going to go back up to normal also. The only sale we have on right now is through the end of May, and that's going to be enforced strictly May 31st. Postmarked or PayPal by then, so I'll give it a couple weeks into June to make sure all the mail's in, is for Oklahoma City. Now, after that, Hour of the Time will no longer be handling the Oklahoma City Day One books whatsoever. So I can already tell you, based on two places I've seen now, they are putting labels over the printed price, which is legal, it's theirs, and charging more than the printed price even. So I suggest you get them on sale now from us, because you're going to pay at least cover price or higher as soon as May's over. And you're going to have to find out where to get them, too, because they're going to be distributed around the country, and we're not going to have anything to do with it after this month. So, again, if you want an Oklahoma City, a soft cover, or a signed hardcover, you need to get those this month, because this will be it. Now, remember, Hour of the Time is listener-supported, and you can help support us through your donations, either outright donations or donations for research materials that come in the form of the videos available in VHS or DVD, or the audios. Our audio catalog is online under the Hot Shop, as well as the books, etc. Also, I've sent out hundreds of the hard copies of the catalog. If you'd like to receive a printed catalog in the mail, just send $5, because I send them flat in a large envelope, and I'll shoot those out to you first class, a catalog of all our audio tapes, audio series, the video, and all the descriptions, and it is completely categorized by date, broadcast title, and show number from the very Bill's very first broadcast of Hour of the Time to the end on November 6th, all right, technically the 5th, 2001. Now, today I have something very special I want to go over the audience. Going through a lot of this paperwork we have here still, I found a couple of written essays that Bill had done that I had forgotten about. We had gathered these together when Bill was getting ready to start his Quaviet book again. You know, as we've told you, we want to get that book published. We have the entire text proofread and on a dish, just waiting for enough funds to be able to publish it. Well, he also had other side monologue pieces and reports that he had written in college courses. And we had had these at one point all together, and just in the hectic scenario of getting the house, you know, all packed up and stuff, they ended up separated. I found these this week, and I'm going to read them on the air. No one's ever heard these before, ever. I'm probably, besides the professor of the English course, Bill wrote them, who graded them. and Bill and myself are probably the only people who've ever read them, and maybe a couple friends, Mike and Bob, etc. The first one I'm going to read, he entitled Vietnam, Are We Still Suffering Casualties 10 Years Later? By Milton W. Cooper. August 5th, 1982. Bill was at the time in Southern California, just so you know, have some background, taking college courses for fun in the evenings. And this was when he was putting back together his memoirs that he had written about Vietnam, like the Quai Viet book from when he first got home. In January 1973, the Vietnam War ended, and the last United States battle casualty had been counted. American troops came home. Gerald R. Ford, when he was president of our country, asked the American people to put Vietnam behind them and forget it, and they promptly did. Tom Williams, a psychologist and Vietnam veteran, responded to the president's request and the American people's reaction with this statement, quote, I can think of no presidential injunction that has been so effective. To put the bitterness and dissension of the war years behind us is both necessary and helpful, but to forget the Vietnam War, its troubled veterans and their families, is unforgivable. End quote. Another Vietnam veteran had this to say, it isn't peace, and there's no honor. More than 8.5 million served in the U.S. Armed Forces during the Vietnam era of 64 to 1973. Approximately 2.8 million were stationed in Southeast Asia. Only 1 million American troops of all four services saw active combat or were exposed to hostile, life-threatening situations. In the years from 1973 to 1978, more Vietnam combat veterans have died by their own hand than were actually killed in Vietnam. Over 600,000 Vietnam-era veterans have left the armed forces with less than honorable discharges. Unemployment rates for Vietnam veterans have been consistently 35% to 50% higher than rates for non-veterans of the same age. The Veterans Administration reports that one out of every five Vietnam-era veterans is experiencing serious and prolonged readjustment problems. The statistics are overwhelming. 20% of the suicide victims in VA psychiatric hospitals are Vietnam veterans, although only 9% of the patients are Vietnam veterans. Bear in mind that these last veterans survived the attempt at suicide and are in addition to the already named statistics. If they had not failed in their purpose, their number killed by their own hand since the war might be double or triple those actually killed in Vietnam. Quote, too many of us believe that the war is over and that we were over too. End quote, said Gary Wood, a combat veteran. Veterans of earlier wars find it difficult, if not impossible, to understand the plight of the Vietnam veteran. All wars are the same, they say, and since there is nothing wrong with us, there can be nothing wrong with the Vietnam veteran. All wars are not the same. The Vietnam War was unlike any other in our history and in the history of the world. Let us examine a quote from Jean de Boulle in Les Juvenciles, a 15th century account of service under Joan d'Arc. It is a joyous thing as war. You love your comrade, so in war. When you see that your quarrel is just and your blood is fighting well, tears rise to your eye. A great sweet feeling of loyalty and of pity fills your heart on seeing your friend so valiantly exposing his body to execute and accomplish the command of our Creator. And then you prepare to go and die or live with him, and for love not to abandon him. And out of that there arises such delectation that he who has not tasted it is not fit to say what a delight it is. Do you think that a man who does that fears death? Not at all, for he feels so strengthened, he is so elated, that he does not know where he is. Truly, he is afraid of nothing. The following are quotes from Vietnam veterans. What am I doing here? We don't take any land. We give it back. We just mutilate bodies. What the hell are we doing here? Something hideous entered our spirits to remain and haunt us forever. One of the ways that the Vietnam War was different was that DROS, which is date of expected return from overseas, each man knew the exact date he would leave for Vietnam and the exact DROS. This made each tour a solitary, individual episode, a personal thing where each man rotated alone. In other wars, units left and returned as a unit, and no one knew the dates. In Vietnam, the soldier felt no continuity with those who preceded or followed him. He felt apart from those with him, but rotating on a different schedule. There was no unit morale or cohesion, and therefore unit integrity can no longer be used as a buffer against the stresses of combat. When the tour ended, the epitaph for the Vietnam veteran was a solitary plane ride home with complete strangers and a head full of grief, conflict, confusion, and joy. For those who may have been struggling with psychological breakdown due to combat stress, did this fantasy play the part of major prophylactic to overt symptoms of acute combat stress reaction? For these veterans, it was a hard-fought struggle to hold on to until time came due. The vast majority did hold on. This is evidenced by the very low neuropsychiatric casualty rates during the Vietnam War. The rate of acute combat reaction and acute post-traumatic stress disorder was significantly lower relative to the two previous wars. The result was that many combatants, who might have become statistics, held on somewhat tenaciously until the end of their tours in Vietnam. The struggle was an uphill battle for the men in Vietnam. Motivators that kept the combatant fighting, unit esprit de corps, small group solidarity, and the ideological beliefs that this was the good fight were not present in Vietnam. Vietnam became a private war of survival for every American individual involved. There is something special about Vietnam veterans. Everyone who has contact with them seems to agree that they are different from veterans of other wars. A favorite word to describe them is alienated. They are not just alienated from society, but also from the men they fought with. Most of the veterans upon DROS had such great feelings of guilt for leaving their buddies behind to whatever fate in Vietnam, they were frightened to find out what happened to their buddies they left. They do not attempt to locate each other, and they do not write letters. A number of studies point out that those veterans subjected to more extensive combat show more problematic symptoms during the period of readjustment. For 500,000 veterans of the combat in Southeast Asia, this problematic outlook has become a chronic lifestyle affecting not only the veterans, but countless millions of persons who are in contact with these veterans. Many of these men, who were under great stress in Vietnam, reached for the quickest cure. The cure was medication, which took the form of narcotic drugs. As a result, many of them are still hooked. Many more resorted to the more traditional alcohol. Now many Vietnam veterans are alcoholics. The classic symptoms of post-traumatic delayed stress syndrome are experienced by all Vietnam combat veterans to varying degrees. However, for some of those with the most extensive combat histories and other variables which have yet to be enumerated, Vietnam-related problems have persisted in disrupting all areas of life experience. The number of Vietnam veterans seriously affected is expected to climb until 1985 based upon belief of Erickson's psychosocial development stages and how far along in these stages most combat veterans will be by 1985. The symptoms of post-traumatic delayed stress syndrome are depression, isolation, rage, alienation, survival guilt, anxiety reactions, sleep disturbance and nightmares, and intrusive thoughts with or without flashbacks. Let us discuss each one at a time. The majority of Vietnam veterans are affected by depression. Most have been depressed since their tour in Vietnam. Classic symptoms are sleep disturbance, psychomotor retardation, feeling of worthlessness, difficulty in concentrating, etc. Excuse me just for 1 second, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, sorry about that. Obviously, someone does not know our air time. The veteran usually demonstrates profuse sweating and complains that he cannot cool off. He would usually have one or more weapons in possession, with the possibility of suicide always present. The veteran will almost always cry when recounting his experiences in Vietnam. Most Vietnam veterans felt isolated and have few, if any, friends. They describe themselves as old men in young men's bodies. The veterans feel distant from their peers. They seem to perpetuate the isolation by constantly switching jobs and geographical location. It is not rare to find Vietnam veterans who have had little or no social contact with women for years. Rage always lies just below the surface of the combat veteran. They seem to strike out at whomever is near, and often for no discernible reason at all. The rage scares the veteran and those around him. It often leads the Vietnam veteran to question his own sanity. The anger repressed in Vietnam and the anger at the way he was treated when he came home seems to lie, a volcano just beneath the surface, waiting. The alienation is obvious. Spouses complain that the men are cold, uncaring individuals. Veterans will admit that they feel nothing when someone dies or is killed. The Vietnam veteran describes himself as emotionally dead. He feels extremely uncomfortable with emotions of love and compassion for others. He is not sure why he exists. Survival guilt is based on the harshest of realities, the actual death of comrades and the struggle of the survivor to live. The survivor often has had to compromise himself or the life of someone else in order to live. The guilt that such an act invokes, or guilt over simply surviving, may eventually end in self-destructive behavior by the survivor. If this problem is not dealt with properly, it can only end in suicide. Vietnam veterans who suffer from anxiety reactions describe themselves as very vigilant human beings. Their autonomic senses are tuned to anything out of the ordinary. A loud discharge will cause many to start or hit the ground. The veteran is uneasy in crowds or with others behind him. He likes to sit against a wall, or even better, in a corner against a solid object. The thicker the wall, the better. All of these behaviors are learned survival techniques. Night is very hard for combat veterans. Most cannot sleep well and find the hours before sleep very uncomfortable. Many stay awake as long as possible, for sleep is a trip back to the combat zone. They suffer from repetitive dreams of Vietnam. The veteran dreams of combat, the death of friends, acts of killing, and other distasteful subjects. For many, the fear they might actually be back in Vietnam is very disquieting. All Vietnam veterans suffer from or experience intrusive thoughts of Vietnam. Most combat veterans cannot get through 1 hour without thinking of Vietnam. The veterans replay especially problematic combat experiences over and over again, searching for possible alternative outcomes to what actually happened in Vietnam. These thoughts are disturbing, but the men are obsessed and are unable to put them to rest. Flashbacks can be triggered by any common everyday experience that remind the veteran of the war zone. Helicopters, smell of urine, smell of diesel fuel, a green tree line, popcorn popping, a loud discharge, rain, and the sight of Vietnamese refugees. The flashback is a dissociative state in which the veteran actually re-experiences past events in Vietnam. He can and does see, hear, feel, smell, and taste Vietnam during a flashback. It is terrifying, and there is a danger that the veteran will be caught up in the flashback and hurt someone. Flashbacks can last from a few seconds to a few hours. Are we still suffering casualties from the Vietnam War? The answer is yes. The statistics are there for anyone to see. The suicides are there if anyone cares. The veterans suffer more and more for those of you with compassion. It is inconceivable that over 67,000 Vietnam combat veterans have committed suicide and no one is excited about it. Only 56,000 died in the war, and the whole nation was in an uproar because of it. Thoughts by a young veteran. The years others knew as youth, I spent learning the meaning of death. The times others spent learning to love, I passed hoping to live through endless nights. The moments others remember as laughs in classrooms, I remember as terror in the jungle. The instants of pleasure taken for granted by others, I remember as forgotten hopes, long ago crushed by the reality of war. The unfulfilled dreams of others are yet to be thought by me, since I am in search of my elusive youth, looking for years lost in combat, which are no more and will never be. To the forgotten warriors. Was the character of my valor less intense than those at Lexington? Was the pain of my wounds any less severe than those at Normandy? And was my loneliness any less sorrowful than those at Inchon? Then why am I forgotten amongst those remembered as heroes? Quote, perhaps someone who read of us will never understand why we did it. Maybe that doesn't even matter now, but we did it because we loved America, and you, America, sent us. We were there when you needed us, and now we need you. We are still your sons. We love America. America, it's time that you love us. From a patient at a VA medical center.
She was a princess, queen of the highway. Sign on the road said, take us to Madre. No one could save her, save the blind tiger. He was a monster, black dressed in leather. She was a princess, queen of the highway. Now they are wedded, she is a good girl. Naked as children, out in the meadow. Naked as children, wild as can be. Soon to have offspring, start it all over. Start it all over.
Alright, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Hour of the Time today on WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 MHz and 9.330 megahertz out of Monticello, Maine. Today, the 4th of May, 2005, Wednesday, I am reading you some of the pieces that Bill had written that have never been read on the air, and probably never read by almost anyone but myself and Bill and his professors in college. This last piece that I read in the first half of the show was entitled Vietnam, Are We Still Suffering Casualties 10 Years Later? By Milton W. Cooper. The next piece I'm going to read is not dated, but I'm going to assume, based on the teacher's writing on the front, that it's probably from the same year. The writing almost looks identical. This one's called Mike and V.A. Bonnie. Mike is an old and dear friend. We met late in the evening in 1968 on a river in Vietnam. I was the captain of a river patrol boat, and Mike was a member of a four-man Marine recon team assigned to my command. We fought side by side, and he has saved my life more than once. Mike and I have developed a trust and friendship between us that can't be broken. We talk rarely of Vietnam. Instead, I write about it, and Mike tries to forget about it. Trying to forget, however, doesn't work for Mike. The pains, angers, and frustration of the war are ripping him apart. I worry about Mike constantly. On the spur of the moment, Mike will show up with fishing poles and tackle box. Before I know what happened, we're sitting on a rock somewhere, drinking beer and fishing with no bait. We're lucky if there's water. Sometimes we end up in our favorite bar. Mike gets wasted and I try to keep him out of trouble. I know Vietnam is really bothering Mike when these episodes take place. I'm the one he picks to lean on. When I ended up in the VA Medical Center, Mike was there every day to help me. He insisted that I live with him so that he could care for me after I left the hospital. Mike hovered over me like an old mother bear, and I mended quickly. Now it is his turn. Soon he will have to go into the VA hospital. It is only a matter of time. I will be there every day, just as Mike was. Mike and I don't talk much. We understand one another perfectly. We play pokes once a week and poker in the back room of a nameless bar. We fish together at least once a week. Neither of us will go drinking without the other. It's damn good to have Mike around. I love him. Bonnie, she is a new friend. She is one of the few women that I have ever been able to be friends with. She does not play any of those stupid games that most women play. Bonnie is honest. We met at the VA Medical Center in early 1981. She is an occupational therapist. Bonnie went out of her way to help me at a time when I was very ill. She knew nothing about the Vietnam War. Bonnie saw so many of us that were screwed up by it, however, that she became curious and began to probe me with questions. We quickly became good friends. Bonnie helps me to get the war out of my system. She is all together. I never worry about Bonnie. We make plans for weekends. Sometimes Bonnie and I go away to be alone. She is my friend, and I sincerely hope our relationship stands upon that foundation. I can be totally different with Bonnie. I can be myself. We sit together for hours, touching and talking softly about the things that are meaningful to us. I can be gentle around her, and if I feel like crying, it's okay. Sometimes we fall asleep on the floor after a long conversation. Later I awake to find her coiled close against me with her arms wrapped tight around my chest. I am overcome with emotion. I lie very still, and sometimes a tear rolls down my cheek and onto hers. Eventually, I go back to sleep, a very happy man. Bonnie and I have a friendship based on trust, want, and need. The need is mostly on my part. She and I talk a lot. Rarely are we silent. When we go out, it's not to drink, although we may have one or two. We frequent art museums and live in live theater performances. Bonnie loves the mountains, and so do I. We sometimes find ourselves high on the slopes and deep in the woods. We sort of experience each other that way. Without Bonnie, I think I would be lost. With her, my life is rich, and I can feel again. She is breaking down the wall I built in Vietnam. I love her.
Work in progress. Take one.
Ladies and gentlemen, again, you're listening to the Hour of the Time on WBCQ, The Planet, out of Monticello, Maine. And those two previous pieces were pieces written by Bill in an English course concerning the Vietnam War, some friends and his experiences, and statistics surrounding those who survived and came home. Now, in keeping with that theme, I want to give you, the audience, some more background from other veterans of that war. This one is a famous poem by a Major Michael O'Donnell. But first, a little prefatory note. Unlike their fathers and grandfathers who served in the First and Second World Wars, the generation of soldiers who returned home from Southeast Asia were greeted by an apathetic and in some cases even hostile nation. There were no ticker tape parades, no mass celebrations, only an embittered sense of how much the war had traumatized the United States. But as time passed, the mood of the country changed. Amid a renewed sense of national optimism, Vietnam veterans were increasingly shown the respect and honor accorded to veterans of other wars. In November 1982, the country formally recognized their sacrifices with the dedication of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Etched in the immense black granite walls of the monument are the names of 58,216 men and 8 military women killed in the war. Each year, tens of thousands of visitors to the wall leave photographs, flowers, personal belongings, and letters in memory of those who died. One of the poems left most frequently at the wall was written by Michael Davis O'Donnell, a young helicopter pilot from Springfield, Illinois. The untitled poem was actually part of a handwritten letter O'Donnell sent to his friend. Excuse me. sent to his best friend Marcus Sullivan, who had served as a combat engineer in the war from 1967 to 1968 and had returned to the United States. O'Donnell's poem has been published before, but the full letter below has not. It was also the last letter Sullivan ever received from his friend. Major Michael O'Donnell's helicopter was shot out of the sky on March 24, 1970, during a rescue mission. His body was never recovered. 2nd of January, 1970. Dear Marcus, I guess we are not very good correspondents. I have raced through the month of December and found I was not entirely unhappy to see it leave. I am right now in the middle of being positive I was never anywhere except Pleiku, Vietnam, this whole lifetime, and I'm sorry to report that I've already played the same good times over and over, and they are beginning to fade out. I think you must know what I mean. It's hard to make the old dreams last, especially when you have no one to make the new ones with. At any rate, I should not complain. It could be much worse. I could be a combat engineer or something. I enjoyed the poems you sent me. I really did. I have tied them up and added them to A Leaf of Life. I have written a few new things. I will send them later. I do not want to give you this one I wrote last night. If you are able, save a place for them inside of you, and save one backward glance when you are leaving for the places they can no longer go. Be not ashamed to say you love them, though you may or may not have always. Take what they have left and what they have taught you with their dying and keep it with your own. And in that time when men decide and feel safe to call this war insane, take one moment to embrace those gentle heroes you left behind.
Well, I'll tell you a story of whiskey and mystics and men, da-da-da, and about the believers and how the whole thing began, da-da-da. First there were women and children obeying the moon, da-da-da. Then daylight brought wisdom and fever and
ladies and gentlemen, we're back with the Hour of the Time. Today, the 4th of May, 2005. Now I'm going to read to you some more memoirs from soldiers who were in the Vietnam War and some of their memories and the way they conveyed them to their family and friends. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, these excerpts after Bill's pieces are taken from a condensed version of a very large book called War Letters, Extraordinary Correspondence from American Wars. It's written by Andrew Carroll. He's also editor of Letters of a Nation. This is a project, by the way, of a all-volunteer project to gather letters up that families may have saved from family members in different conflicts throughout history. It's called the Legacy Project. It can be seen at warletters.com. And they gather these letters and print them for free distribution. These pocket-sized copies are an Armed Services edition, much like the World War II era books. So they're small, they can fit in a pocket of, let's say, a uniform, and given out free to soldiers on duty. Now this next piece is by Lieutenant Colonel Gerald W. Massey III, where he offers his daughter Lynn a first-hand report of the Tet Offensive as it unfolded all around him. On the eve of Tet, the Vietnamese Lunar New Year, observed at the end of January, Viet Cong and North Vietnamese soldiers swarmed out of the jungles and struck airfields, military installations, and over 100 towns and provincial capitals throughout the South. American and South Vietnamese troops, many of whom were on furlough to celebrate the holiday, were caught entirely off guard. In a move more symbolic than tactically significant, Viet Cong commandos infiltrated the courtyard of the American Embassy in Saigon and blasted a hole through an embassy wall. Hue, the ancient imperial capital, was entirely overrun. The liberation of the city would take weeks and was one of the bloodiest battles of the war. 52-year-old Lieutenant Colonel Gerald W. Massey III, a reconnaissance pilot with the Antique Airlines, that's the name of a group of older U.S. airmen flying in Vietnam, which they'd affectionately chosen for themselves, wrote frequently to his 18-year-old daughter, Lynn, about his service. During the Tet Offensive, Massey provided Lynn with an eyewitness account of the firestorm raging outside his base. 2 February, 1968. Dear Lynn, I have just sent a message to Mama through Mars. The only fairly rapid means available to me now that I am okay and I am assume she'll phone you. I know that you are all worried, and I'm sorry that you must suffer such anxiety, but you understand, of course, that I am only one of a 500,000 American troops, plus said state, aid, and other American personnel who are caught here in this all-out attack by the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, all supported by Russian and Red Chinese arms, of course. We all have anxious families and are all in the same boat. We cannot get word home yet. But Mars told me the message, which is a standard message, and I cannot personalize it, will reach Mama in 1 to 36 hours. It's the best I can do, though I have written to Mama since the attack began. Heaven knows when she will get the letters. No mail has entered or departed here since the attack, and that's understandable, since conditions are such that other, more urgent cargo must now be handled by the greatly reduced airlift capacity now available to us. I am now on Tan Son Hut, living in unfinished barracks with no screens, windows, doors, seals, or lights, except for emergency lighting in the halls, and there is no operational latrine. I am sleeping on a mattress without bedding, on the floor, and there is no furniture. I have devised a table from a door, not yet installed, laid across two high saw horses, and then seated on a small step ladder, and that is where I am typing now. We were evacuated from our off-base BOQ late yesterday, after 36 hours of small arms fire nearby, often within a block. We had no phones and weapons at first, but managed to get some M16s and rifles and pistols late Wednesday, so that Wednesday night we could mount an additional guard to supplement the Chinese Noon Guards, who are hired by the Air Force to guard our quarters. Last night, after we arrived on base, the enemy attacked the base again from all directions and there was much gunfire. I spent much of the night at my open window, pistol drawn, expecting an attack on these and nearby barracks, where gunfire within a block of us erupted frequently, and our Army and Air Force security guards in flak vests, helmets, and full battle gear were moving about in darkened vehicles or on foot, crouching and darting from cover to cover, looking for the enemy. Flares filled the sky and helicopter gunships roared around at rooftop level. Now and then, a furious gun battle would erupt, then subside, with only occasional sporadic light arms fire to punctuate the silent darkness. The enemy has apparently launched a massive all-or-nothing assault on all our major installations throughout South Vietnam, timed to coincide with the Vietnamese New Year called Tet. He has achieved some initial success, but is now being driven back with huge losses, and I think the critical danger has passed. There is still danger, though, and we have seen a remarkable demonstration of what the enemy can do. Who flew by, where I was recently stationed for a couple weeks, may have been overwhelmed, I'm not sure at this moment, but I do know that all the troops in my outfit there were successfully evacuated to Da Nang and subsequently to Nha Trang. I am finding it a bit difficult to type, for I burned myself with hot grease quite severely on the head, right hand, right arm, and right leg just hours before this attack began. If I must use my pistol, I will have to be in my left hand, and I have been practicing holding and aiming it that way, steady by my bandaged right hand. The burns are bad and painful, but not crucial. I'll be back flying in 2 or 3 weeks. Your letter expressing concern about the latest development in Korea reached me a couple of days before the attack, and I understand your feelings, while at the same time I am glad to hear you express faith in your country. You asked for my opinion for guidance, and I am glad to give it. I want first to point out that American history is filled with dark moments when the odds were great, and we have never failed to meet each challenge. The present situation is no more urgent or filled with danger than was the attack on Pearl Harbor, nor is this moment in history any blacker for us than it was at Valley Forge, or Gettysburg, or Bataan, or the Alamo. There is one big difference now, and that is the area of our greatest concern. In those days, Americans were not so adept at wringing their hands despairingly, as seems to be the case with many of our countrymen now, young and old. If fears were felt in years gone by, and you can bet they were, people had less trouble concealing them because it was an unpopular thing to show fear, or conversely, not to appear brave and resolute. Today, in some circles, it appears to be the thing to do to reject our previous ideas about the virtue of personal courage. In my judgment, these people are more dangerous as enemies of our country and our liberty than the Nazis or the Communists ever were. Our national anthem has a line which is appropriate to quote here, "The land of the free and the home of the brave." The two go hand in glove. If we are not brave, we will soon not be free. No nation or person ever achieved greatness or even success without courage. I would hate to think what would happen to America if all of those of us who are now in Vietnam, in the face of this attack, which is more real and personal to us than all the academic discussions and all the campuses of America, were to turn tail and run. Can you imagine such a thing? Neither can I. So why should comfortable civilians back home quit in despair? Maybe some do not appreciate America. Let them visit many other lands as I have, and they will thank God for the blessing of being an American. Maybe some fear the nuclear weapons of the day. You die just as dead from a bow and arrow, and in numbers just as great from pogroms by Genghis Khans or Hitlers or Stalins or Mao's. You are growing up, sweetie, and more you will come to know that life rewards the strong and punishes the weak. So does history. The greater the heights of achievement, the greater the strength and resolution demanded. America is now the greatest human achievement in history, in spite of some of the weak among us. Can you suppose that they contributed to our greatness? And the length of the shadow which we cast into the future depends on how tall we stand now, just as it always has. Don't worry about our country and don't worry about me. I am not afraid, so don't you be either. And you might recommend this kind of attitude to any of your friends who might profit from it. Your loving daddy.
I will never
Cause if you do, you're gonna lose the best friend that you ever had. That's no lie.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank everyone for tuning in today to the Hour of the Time, today the 4th of May 2005. You've been listening to the Hour of the Time on WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 MHz and 9.330 MHz out of Monticello, Maine. Excuse me. If you'd like to write the Hour of the Time, it is P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. Our website, hourofthetime.com, and our message line is 928-333-2942. Again, that's 928-333-2942. Now remember, ladies and gentlemen, we are listener supported, and your donations allow us to maintain this show and our, of course, overhead expenses and the website that's available every day of the year. So please, if you find it in yourselves, make a donation, either directly or for research materials out of our catalog, and it would be greatly appreciated. Be sure to tune in tomorrow for another live, exciting episode of the Hour of the Time. Thank you.